This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, welcome to The Country Hour. It's great to have you company. I'm Cassie Huff, and it was also great to read South Australia's farmers' confidence levels are at their highest point in 10 years. Good winter rainfall and strong commodity prices have helped with that. So I'll have some more on what these confidence levels mean for the state. And some of that confidence might be eroded with the increasing difficulty some sectors are having in accessing export containers. And as a result, freight costs are soaring.
2 to 3 times higher than last year, so it's a significant amount of money. I can tell you, for instance, that into the Middle East, the rates are sort of $7,000 US a container, whereas maybe 1 year ago they were around $2,000 US. So that just gives you some insight as to what how that market's increased.
I'll have more on that, particularly for the hay industry soon, but first to the outlook for the nation, and it seems Australian farming has never been worth so much. Economists at the Australian Bureau of Agriculture and Resource Economics and Sciences now expect the Aussie farm sector will produce $73 billion worth of produce this financial year. ABS spokesman Jared Greenville says it would be a jump of 8% on the $66 billion of value the industry produced last year.
Well, we've had a couple of good things really come together at the same time. So the first is, of course, for Australian agriculture, the weather. We've had some pretty good seasonal conditions and a really good turnaround in what we were expecting seasonal conditions to be earlier in the year, with that negative Indian Ocean dipole heading around and leading to what will be one of the biggest winter crops that we've had, another near record winter crop. And that's been combined at the same time with some strong global prices across the board, across grain, sugar and cotton. And that's really being driven by some pretty poor seasonal conditions elsewhere in the world, particularly in North America, which is really forcing some of the prices up for our grain exports. We're also starting to see some dividends from what has been some herd rebuilding in the national, you know, cattle herd and sheep flock. And so there's more product, more meat coming onto market as a result of that.
So the livestock sector is having a good time of it. The grain skies are going well. But dairy too is benefiting, I guess, from China's inability to or the high prices for feed for domestic production in China.
Yeah, there's been a combination of both higher prices for feed, or higher costs really for Chinese milk producers in terms of feed, but also a big push for more consumption of milk products in China. So Chinese dairy producers are producing more milk, but largely for the drinking milk market, which has led to processors really looking to the international market to get hold of, you know, manufactured milk to go into a number of manufacturing processes. And that's really helped up our prices at home here as we're selling more of that into China.
The forecast today from ABARES also expects record farm gate returns in the horticulture sector. What's driving that?
So with horticulture, it's again the seasonal conditions story, but also we've had some fairly, I guess, continued price rises as a result of really the labour shortages that are affecting the sector. So while prices are up, there are some issues with trying to get all that product off farms and into consumers' hands. And so we would normally expect a season like this for prices to start to fall, but we've had a continued pattern of price growth, which we wouldn't have otherwise seen. And that's starting to then weigh on total gross value of production. But a lot of that will go through into increased cost for farmers.
Okay, and if we have a look at the labour issues, it's not just the horticulture sector. The report today makes mention of the wool industry as well as cotton growers. And, of course, we've heard a lot about the grain harvest, the forecast shortage of workers there. What impact's that really having on this bottom line?
Yeah, so there's a number of watch points with those industries in terms of getting hold of people to I guess, get the crops and production out of fields and into silos and into markets. At the moment, we're expecting really that it's unlikely to have a big impact on national production, although there could be some localised issues. Where it will come down to is again, cost, with, you know, producers either having to, you know, bid up the price of labour, trying to get people to come and work. But also there's, you know, opportunities which don't come, you know, free to delay harvests in some ways, is trying to get hold of, you know, that labour as it comes available off other farms. So that's where we're expecting to see the main kind of impacts coming through.
One other thing to the report touches on is the cost of freight and access to containers. Is this really sort of emerging as quite a pressing issue for the sector?
It's starting to emerge, certainly, as an issue for the sector and, I guess, supply chains across the world. We're seeing particularly containerised freight starting to see prices rise fairly substantially, not to unheard of levels, but they're going up quite significantly. With changes in freight patterns and the like, that can start to impact some of our products. Most of the bulk export's still going ahead. So at this stage, it seems, particularly when we look at how fast some of our crops have gone out of the country in response to, you know, better seasonal conditions last year, at this stage things seem to be still flowing, but that's certainly going to start to, I guess, squeeze some of the margins a little bit. But with good international prices and the like, the sector is actually in a pretty good position to look at some of these challenges.
Jared Greenville, the Executive Director at ABES, he was speaking with Kath Sullivan. And speaking of the increased cost of exporting, Australian hay exporters may struggle to get all their product to consumers overseas due to this shortage of shipping containers. Now, many people have noticed this. Hay exporter Gilmax CEO Munro Patchett says freight costs are already 2 to 3 times more than they were last year. Mr. Patchett says growers need to speak with their exporters early to make sure they can find a home for their hay.
Yeah, sea freight's become a big problem lately. So the vessels heading to North Asia are very full. There's a lot of bottlenecks in Singapore and some of the transshipment ports, and it's creating a lot of issues. We're seeing huge delays in getting cargo to where it needs to go. We're also seeing sea freight rates increase significantly. We're probably around double to triple this time last year. Just as the shipping lines incur higher costs, they're passing them on to shippers, which ultimately will be passed on to, you know, suppliers and to customers.
Well, I know it does depend on a lot. You said that the shipping rates are higher. Could you buy about 2 or 3 times? What sort of costs are we talking about here?
Well, 2 to 3 times higher than last year. So it's a significant amount of money. Different port pairs have different costs, and they do vary. Some outer ports are very expensive and some are cheaper. I can tell you, for instance, that into the Middle East, the rates are sort of $7,000 US a container, whereas maybe 1 year ago they were around $2,000 US. So that just gives you some insight as to what how that market's increased.
And what impact is that going to have on the hay exporters and, I suppose, the industry as a whole?
Oh, I just think it's going to make it more challenging to get decent volumes up there in a reasonable fashion. And with the dry conditions in North America and Canada, we've probably got a little bit of grace on our side. But if, you know, if there's no space on vessels, you simply can't get it on. You're competing with other things, and it's just going to make it more challenging.
I suppose, is there actually a realistic chance that hay might not be able to get to where it needs to be in time to take advantage of some of the demand in North America? Or is it just like it's just going to take a lot longer for the clients to receive what they've paid for?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure about that. I would say that probably, you know, hay will certainly go out there, but maybe not 100% of what people want. It might be sort of 80, 90%, and there might be significant delays. And there'll be opportunities missed by exporters to sell more hay up there due to the tight shipping situation.
What are your expectations for the Australia's hay harvest at the moment?
Well, at the moment, it's looking pretty good right the way across Australia. Probably above average yields in Western Australia and average in Victoria and South Australia at this stage. Some areas a little bit under, but many are over. So overall, I would say there's an average hay crop available this year.
Is that necessarily, though, a good thing? We've seen that there have been some issues with export to China, with a number of export licenses not being renewed. While there might be a good, decent harvest, how is the market looking?
The traditional markets are looking pretty good. We've got Japan, South Korea and Taiwan taking probably above average tonnages due to dry conditions out of North America and Canada. So there's quite good demand there. China is taking about one third of what they used to from the three registered exporters still able to export there in Australia. All the other exporters have not had their licences or their registrations renewed at this time. So the market is smaller than what it was 12 months ago. But I think the traditional markets will take more than they normally take.
So we have seen that there's been there's been some decent rain conditions around around Australia. There's obviously been, like you said, the export market will be is expected to be smaller with those issues with China. So why, I suppose, is that going to create issues with too much hay being around?
Yeah, I think it's important that hay growers need to speak to their exporter or their market and just find out what they require this year. The last thing anybody wants is too much hay being made that doesn't have a home. If it doesn't fit into sheds, there's a chance it will get rained on, or you know, the mice will get into it or something. Exporters do have a requirement. I think it's important that people need to speak to them. Some exporters have given out contracts. In our case, we've contracted all of our hay. Others haven't, but it's important that people understand what exporters can handle and then act on that information.
Gil Max Munro Padgett speaking with Lucas Forbes. It's 16 minutes past 12 on the Country Hour.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, we've got the good news of a record amount of agriculture production in the coming financial year, but the headwind of some issues when it comes to containers. But it seems overall the good seasonal conditions across much of the state and strong commodity prices have pushed South Australian farmers' confidence levels to their highest level in a decade. Now, that is set to boost investment in the ag sector across the state, with about a third of farmers surveyed saying that they want to increase the investment in their farm business. So, confidence to reinvest back into their businesses. Deputy Regional Manager for Rabobank SA, Adam Moss, says it's great to see such an optimistic outlook for South Australia.
Well, as you said, Cassie, great to see that it's the highest level of confidence since March 2011. And what that is made up of is that 52% of surveyed farmers have told us that they're expecting a higher income in the 21-22 year than last year. Really pleasingly, 82% of grain producers are expecting a higher income. So a really big driver to that level of income that you're talking about.
Last year was quite a significant grain crop as well. So the grain growers are certainly leading the charge in South Australia. But beyond just grain, what other sectors are confident?
Well, grain is the real standout. So that is really driving confidence to a new level. So 82% of the sort of grain producers expect higher income. Overall, 52%. But 42% of farmers expect conditions to improve. 52% of those surveyed expect similar conditions to last year, so that's pretty good, and only 2% expect to see a deterioration. Beef producers, we've seen 56% of beef producers expecting better conditions, and 67% of sheep producers expect better conditions this year over last year.
South Australia had a late start to the cropping season, but June and July largely delivered. August was a little lean in some parts, though, rain-wise, and September, while it's only early days, it's been quite dry as well. How much will this season affect the farmers' confidence going forward?
September will be critical. So we had a warmer start than average for the first few days of September and probably a little bit drier. So we will need to see a good finish with rain through September. And you know, realistically, hopefully seeing some rain will mean that that we'll avoid that risk of late frost damage. So at the moment, things are looking quite well. But as always, that finishing rain is going to be important. So I think that all our producers know that it's not over until the grain is in the silo and money in the bank, but certainly looking very strong with confidence levels reflecting that at the moment.
How does South Australian farmers' confidence compare to other states?
It's actually quite high nationally. So most areas across Australia have received good conditions in terms of weather, and also commodity prices are high across the board. So we're doing really well, but a real standout when it comes to that level of confidence from grain producers, as you would expect in South Australia.
You mentioned farmer investment is on the rise. What are some of the main things that they're looking at spending their money on?
property acquisition seems to be forefront, but I think it's a time when people are starting to think about the machinery, the infrastructure on farm, technology. So really in all areas, it's just that opportunity to make hay while the sun shines, I guess, and invest to make sure that farmers are in a good position for the future.
Just hopefully some decent September rain delivers on that promise. That was Deputy Regional Manager of Rabobank SA, Adam Moss. Now, before I get to weather, this is the time of year when frost is of particular concern, but West Australian scientists believe they can develop a frost-tolerant wheat variety using gene editing technology. Professor Michael Jones is the Director of Biotechnology at Western Australia's Murdoch University. He says they've already tested wheat anti-frost genes in tobacco, and trials have shown the plant survives.
You can freeze them to, well, treat them -4 degrees, for example, and they will recover and grow and set seed. Whereas if you have control plants which don't have that gene, then most of them die and they don't recover. And, you know, it's just like putting lettuce in the freezer. It doesn't last very long. So what this shows is that these antifreeze genes actually do work. So that gives us confidence to go ahead and put all the effort to make sure that we can increase their expression in wheat itself.
So my understanding is you're looking at getting wheat to survive in cold conditions because it already can in other parts of the world. Can you explain how wheat is tolerant to frost in really cold places?
Well, yes. If you think about winter wheat that's grown in Europe or North America that's sown in the autumn, it germinates and so you have a plant that's growing there, and then the winter comes, they stop growing, they can be hard frosts and snow cover, and so they sit there quite happily, and then when the spring comes, so they perk up and start growing, and then they during the warmer times of the year you've got anthesis and grain development and then harvest. And so what that tells us is that there are proteins or the products of genes in wheat and barley which protect against frost damage. The problem is that they are not expressed in the conditions when we grow wheat in Australia. Because, in fact, of course, we plant our wheat in the autumn. It's growing during the rainy season. And just as the plants are heading, So anthesis and early grain filling is when the frost events occur, like more or less now. And so then the plants suffer from frost damage, and then you get loss of yield, and it's really quite serious. So what we're trying to do is tweak the expression of endogenous genes. So we found anti-frost genes that are present, and the aim of this work is to increase their level of expression so that they are expressed at the time of anthesis and grain filling in Australian WA germplasm.
Do you know how those genes, or the protein, I think you called it, how do they actually work?
They're also called IRIPs. So this is they prevent ice recrystallization. So when you get frost water freezing, you get small crystals. But in fact, they can get larger. And when they get large, then they damage the cells and the cell membranes and make them leaky. So these proteins actually bind to the ice and prevent them from getting any bigger. So they protect from seriousness of frost damage from big ice crystals.
How fascinating. So the ice can still form, but because the crystals don't get large, it doesn't damage the plant.
Yes, because it's mainly in the cell wall space, not in the cells.
So you're hoping to make that anti-frost gene active in Australian wheat right about now when it is cold and frosty. How are you doing that?
We're using a process of gene editing. So this is a new technology which allows you to make changes or mutations in a sequence. So it's like targeted mutagenesis, it's also known as. And so we can look at the sequences which are responsible for controlling expression of genes. They're called promoters. And there are some specific parts of those which reduce the expression of the protein. So we can edit those bits and stop them inhibiting the expression of the antifrost proteins. So they then get expressed. They can either be throughout the plant or in particular parts of the plant.
Michael Jones, Director of the West Australian State Agricultural Biotechnology Centre, speaking with Lucinda Jose about their research work to try and develop frost-tolerant wheat using gene editing technology. It could take about 3 to 5 years, Professor Jones thinks, before they'll have something ready for farmers, but they're certainly working on it. That'll be interesting to see how that comes off. Now, I'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now to see if the weather is going to help South Australian farmers deliver on the promise that you've heard through this program. Good afternoon to Senior Forecaster Tom Bowick. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So it's starting to warm up a bit this week.
Yes, it's pretty mixed as it often is this time of year. So we did have a cold start this morning, notably minus 1.8 degrees at Keith West for a minimum, minus 0.6 of a degree at Snowtown, minus 0.4 at Roseworthy, and minus 0.3 of a degree at Murray Bridge. It's been largely dry today. The only exception there is in the far northwest there. We have had some isolated shower and thunderstorm activity, probably sort of north of about Cooper Pedy. And at the moment, there is still some thunderstorm activity between about Oodnadatta and Cooper Pedy. And it's expected that through that northern sector, probably north of about Cooper Pedy to Murray, that there's a chance of some thunderstorm activity this afternoon, but they are pretty isolated. So moving into Wednesday then, we do have cold conditions at first for the eastern districts, so there may be some frost areas again for those districts, and for the rest of the state for the day it'll be dry, temperatures will be on the mild side, grading to warm to hot in the northwest of the state. And then moving into Thursday, rising temperature is the trend there, with winds turning northerly ahead of a change moving into the far west of the state later. Some instability moving into the northern parts with a chance of some gusty thunderstorms in the north there, so probably sort of well north of about Port Augusta. It will be mostly dry, so not much rainfall in those thunderstorms. And temperature-wise, we're looking at mild to warm, grading to hot in the west and the far north with increasing northerly winds. For Friday, we have the change moving across from the west. There will be a slight to medium chance of showers extending for most districts, increasing up to a medium to high chance of showers for the southeast. We've got some possible gusty thunderstorms about the eastern districts and also over the pastoral and Flinders districts to the east of about Cooper Pedy. Temperatures will be warm in the south and west, grading to hot in the northeast. And it's certainly going to be having those fresh northerly winds. There'll be a moderate fresh west to southwesterly change expected to be extending over the west and south, though. And then as we move into Saturday, change sort of is moving to the east. Slight chance of showers for the agricultural area in the northeast pastoral district, up to a medium to high chance of showers for the southern agricultural area. Much cooler though, cool to cold in the south, still warm in the far north, but the majority of the state will be much milder, and winds will be moderate southwest to southeasterly. Then for the remainder of the weekend and early next week, we've just got a slight chance of some showers for the northern agricultural area, not a great deal in that, increasing up to a medium high chance to high chance over the southern agricultural area. And sort of continuing cool to cold in the south, so cooler period there, grading to warm in the far north of the state. Now, rainfall totals, it's not too much happening for the next week, but a little bit of rainfall, particularly for the south. So looking at the period from now until midnight on Saturday, it's expecting less than 2 millimetres, but it should be dry in the west. Higher totals of 2 to 5 millimetres for the southern agricultural area, and also associated with any thunderstorm activity. There's an isolated chance of some falls of 5 to 10 millimetres. Near the southern coasts and also for the lower southeast district. So, that's about it. Back to you, Cassie.
Thanks for that, Tom Bowick. We'll need to rustle up a bit more rain, but hopefully it comes through soon. Thanks for that forecast. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be sunny. There could be a chance of some frost in the northeast in the early morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 2 to 9 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the low to mid-20s. The lower western will be mostly sunny. There is a chance of some morning frost in the far east as well. Overnight, though, temperatures will get down to rather chilly, 1 to 4 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the low 20s. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're going to look at avocado quality. Have you noticed an improvement in the quality of avocados at the supermarket over the last couple of years? We'll take a look at what's being done to do that. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to the Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie
Huff. Hi, welcome. I'm so glad you could join me. And you've probably noticed that there are a lot of avocados on the market at the moment. And if you're a long-time avocado lover, you might have noticed an improvement in the quality of avos. It's something the industry has been working hard on to reduce the amount of bruising and things like that. So soon I'll explain how a supermarket monitoring program is trying to do just that. And I'd be interested to know if you've actually noticed a change in avocado quality through the past couple of years. Text me on 0467922891 or phone 1300 222891. Have you noticed some less bruising or perhaps more? How are your avos coming to you? Are they meeting your standards? Let me know, 0467922891. Also today, it can be hard enough toilet training toddlers, but imagine trying to toilet train a cow.
So we use a procedure that a lot of people use with toddlers, and that is that you associate the place where they need to go. You know, you might have a potty in the bathroom. So here we have a pen that's clearly identified, nice green pen, green floor and everything. And we rewarded them every time they urinated in there.
It might sound silly, but cow urine can be a bit of a problem for things like grasses and soils, so I'll have more on that soon. First to Wendy Glamatic with the news headlines. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, New South Wales has recorded 1,127 new local cases of coronavirus, as well as another two deaths. A woman in her 80s has died at the Ryde Hospital, and a man in his 50s passed away at the Concord Hospital. Both had had one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Victoria, meanwhile, has recorded 445 new cases of COVID-19 and two more deaths. South Australia's Police Commissioner has confirmed plans are being developed with COVID Transition Committee for South Australia's base level of restrictions once an 80% vaccination rate is reached. SA's current vaccination rate is around 40%, according to SA Health. Grant Stevens says the state has to be prepared for what's coming, and the plan remains to relax borders once the vaccination target is achieved. And in other news, the peak body for resettlement services says that making most migrants wait 4 years before claiming benefits will entrench childhood inequality. The federal government wants to delay access to family tax benefits, the carer's allowance and paid parental leave. The change would not affect humanitarian visa holders and would save the government $670 million over 4 years. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Wendy. South Australia's Shop Workers Union has lodged a claim in the federal court against the operator of 20 Foodland and IGA supermarkets in South Australia's regions. The SDA alleges Adelaide-based company Yidunda Farmers Limited owes at least 64 workers more than $1 million in unpaid wages. The union's Josh Peak says the workers claim they weren't paid overtime rates and other entitlements under the retail award over several years.
So for some time the union has been investigating concerns that we've had that workers working for Yidunda Farmers Limited, which is a major supermarket chain in regional South Australia, have been systematically underpaid over many years. And the result of that investigation is that the SDA has launched legal action at the federal court claiming over $1 million worth of underpayments against Yidunda Farmers Limited on behalf of 64 workers. And this is very significant. Most of these workers look like they've been underpaid over $10,000 a year. And we believe that there may be many hundreds of workers out there that have also been underpaid. And we're really calling on them to come forward so that we can pursue back pay on their behalf as well.
64 workers are involved in this class suit. So what are they hoping to receive from Yidunda Farmers?
Well, look, it's very significant. We've had 64 current and former workers come forward and complete affidavits claiming that they have been underpaid over many years whilst working for this company, and we're just claiming for them what's rightfully theirs, for there to be back paid their lost income, and for the company to be penalised for the systematic underpayments that we'll be alleging. This is a Adelaide-based company that has been allegedly underpaying workers right across regional South Australia for many years, and it's just not good enough to have that sort of income ripped out of the pockets of regional workers for a corporate based in Adelaide to be making money off the back of these hard-working workers in regional communities.
SDA Secretary Josh Peake speaking with Sarah Tomevska. Udunda Farmers was contacted for comment but has not yet replied. The avocado industry, though, is sending people out into supermarkets across the country to check out the quality of the fruit sold in stores. Now, the Avocado Quality Monitoring Program sees these samplers select, they cut, they peel and they weigh avocados to check for damage, including fruit rot and bruising, because there is nothing worse when you're really looking forward to an avocado to cut into it and find that it's half black. Adam Goldwater from Applied Horticulture Research says halfway through the project, they have seen a great improvement in produce compared to a similar study 5 years ago.
A great result for the Australian industry. It's going to be important over the next year, as the industry faces a large increase in supply, that they can maintain that improvement. So really continuing on with this project for another year and a half is going to be really important to check as we see it. Well, there's going to be an avocado flood. As we've seen already, there's a lot of fruit coming through into the supermarkets and prices have come back quite a lot.
How much had the quality of avocados sold to consumers improved?
What we've sort of found is that close to 90% of the avocados we've assessed meet consumer quality requirements. But looking back sort of 5 years ago, that was hovering more around the 80% mark. So it's lifted a bit. But like I said, the next sort of year and a half is going to be really telling us if that level's maintained.
Jumping back, you mentioned that, there had been a really big improvement and that growers were really looking at different ways to make sure that what was on the shelves people wanted to buy. What do you think were some of the steps that have been taken to improve that quality of produce?
I guess one of the key things that has probably improved is the growing practices. So growers being able to control diseases better so that the fruit don't rot. That's often a key issue that we come across. So better control of disease in the orchard. But also through the supply chain, there's probably better temperature management is another factor that's led to the improvement. And just more general awareness, the industry's invested quite heavily in making all the industry stakeholders aware of what the best practice is and what everyone should, through the supply chain, should be doing to get the avocado to the consumers in the best condition possible.
How have consumers changed the way that they buy avocados?
I guess what has been changing is that demand's increasing. So I don't know the exact numbers, but as supply has increased over probably at least the last 20 years in Australia, demand has consistently increased as well, which is fantastic for the avocado industry.
Of course, I'm sure some of that might be partly driven by the growth of the smashed avocados for brunch. But is that consumer demand rising enough to meet this flood of avocados?
So there's a large increase in supply this season as we speak, and some of the suppliers are looking at export, so trying to reduce the amount of fruit on the domestic market. So I guess, we can't expect consumers to suddenly buy 50% more avocados in 1 year. So, look, the industry is looking at export markets to reduce that level of supply domestically.
It's been around 3 years since squeeze-stopping trials were introduced in some supermarkets. Do you know much about how the take-up of that has been?
So we actually did some work looking at separating ripe and unripe fruit on the display. So it was an eat-now and an eat-later side of the display, trying to make it easy for consumers to select the fruit that they wanted to take home and at the same time reduce the number of times they're squeezing fruit, because every time someone squeezes the fruit, there's bruising that develops from that. So that browning in the fruit, that when you cut a fruit open, is very often caused by someone squeezing the fruit. So the uptake from that, there was reasonable uptake. We're still really working with a number of the other supermarkets to try and implement a system like that. There is considerable interest in it because of the reduction in bruising that resulted from that.
Adam Goldwater from Applied Horticultural Research speaking to Eliza Ballage about some of the work they're doing to improve the quality of avocados in the supermarket. And if you've changed, maybe you're not squeezing them as much, or you've noticed a change in the quality of avocados, text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Now, another supermarket staple is eggs. And would you believe it? COVID lockdowns have seen Australians consuming more eggs, quite a lot more eggs. The average increase of more than one egg per person per year for a total of 49. And the trust level for the egg industry has hit 80%, up 65% from just a couple of years ago. Free-range eggs lead the way. They're the most popular category. Rowan McManus, Managing Director of Australian Eggs, says Australians are buying more eggs as they are happier with the animal welfare standards, food safety, and seeing eggs as healthier.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an interesting period, this COVID times, and it's been quite disruptive from an egg production and consumption point of view. But what we've seen around that is quite steady demand and even increased demand of Australian consumers for eggs, and also steady supply. The disruption comes in the middle. I mean, many more people are cooking eggs at home, and we have seen retail sales increase, but of course, we've been plagued by lockdown. So those opportunities to consume eggs at cafes have been limited at times, including right now in Sydney and Melbourne. Egg farmers have had to kind of shape shift to deal with that across what's now a year and a half. And I think it's been a credit to them that they've been able to, and supply's been able to find and meet that demand.
And how much, do you know, percentage-wise, has demand increased, do you think?
Only slightly, yeah. So egg consumption per capita has gone up from 48 eggs per person per year last year to 49, I think, 49.2, I believe, this year. So that's a very slight increase, but given the level of disruption that we've faced, it's quite remarkable. And as I say, I think a credit to the farmers that have been able to get the eggs through to the consumers.
So I guess the other thing is too that you've found that eggs are increasing in popularity too. People are feeling better about eating eggs.
Yeah, that's right. So we've done some research recently, and we're really pleased that the latest round of research indicates that trust has gone up. And it's gone up slightly on last year, but really since 2018, it's gone up considerably, almost 10%. And we now have community trust in the egg industry at around 65%, but also acceptance of the egg industry even higher, up around 80%.
Do you think that there's a changing perception about, you know, healthy eating and eggs aren't full of cholesterol and, you know, that health message has changed around eggs a bit?
Oh, it certainly has, and I believe it continues to put wind in our sails. So we had that period in the 80s and 90s where people were very concerned about the link between eggs, cholesterol and heart health. But slowly but surely, as more and more research was conducted, we've been able to establish that eggs are healthy to eat. So overcoming the cholesterol myth was a big success factor, a big growth factor coming out of the 2000s. But now, people are striding into egg consumption for their health even more broadly. And we know there's a lot of focus on health and fitness and the nutrition benefits of eggs are frankly increasingly understood, but somehow still barely understood by the Australian public. And the more people become aware of it, we're seeing egg consumption grow and grow.
And what about the animal welfare issues and the move? We are seeing, you know, a big buying push for free-range eggs. Does that play into people's concerns about animal welfare and caged eggs?
Yeah, well, I think welfare is a key issue for all animal industries, and it certainly comes through strongly as a key issue for the egg industry. You've got to remember the important distinction between sort of consumer views and what people choose to buy, and then the sort of community perceptions and trust in the egg industry, which is at a broader level. And that's what this research really relates to. So at that level, that community trust level, they're looking for us to make improvements in welfare over time. And that's been the focus over the last 4 years. And we've been able to demonstrate our ability to do that.
Australians are buying more free-range eggs, aren't they? Maybe that is because they feel more comfortable buying those sorts of eggs as opposed to caged eggs.
Oh, absolutely. People would only buy the egg that they're comfortable with. And there's been a very long trend that's gone 15 or more years now of increase in the free-range segment. It frankly started off niche around 2000, and now it's very much mainstream. In fact, through supermarkets, it's the largest category. And then you've got barn and, of course, cage. But look, cage continues to be strong. What the community trust research has showed us is, you know, there isn't a singular community as it relates to any issue or any welfare issue. There's multiple communities, and you've still got around a third of Australians eating caged eggs and presumably very happily. In research has been conducted on why people buy free-range eggs, and it's because they have a perception that it's a better egg. Mm. And if that's what they perceive, and they're seeing value in that, well, the egg industry wants to be there to supply them an egg.
Rowan McManus, who is the Managing Director of Australian Eggs, speaking with Michael Condon. It's 1:45.
Inspiring audiobooks from some of Australia's most beloved storytellers are now free to stream on the ABC Listen app.
This isn't just my story. This is the story of so many other young people.
The best homegrown fiction.
Tilly decided she would go back to Dungatar.
Real life Australian stories.
Some of what I've done has not been pretty to watch. Imagine what it was like to live through it.
And so much more.
This is paradise.
A great range of audiobooks free to stream on the ABC Listen app.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's great to have your company. I'm Cassie Huff, and soon I'll tell you how to toilet train a cow. But first, an Eyre Peninsula mine development is moving forward with a deal struck between a South Australian graphite developer and a South Korean lithium iron battery mineral supplier. The MOU between SA's Renascor Resources and POSCO will support a $209 million investment to develop a manufacturing facility for the Sivia mine. The Sivia mine is planned near Arno Bay, and the project could potentially generate $260 million a year in exports. Renascor Resources Managing Director David Christensen explains what the new MOU means.
I guess the most exciting recent news is we announced a major offtake agreement with the South Korean conglomerate POSCO, who would be purchasing up to 30,000 tons of graphite in a purified spherical form from our operation. And that's really transformative in a number of ways. This new one with POSCO is our fourth for 30,000 tons. POSCO has traditionally been a very good trading partner to Australian companies, and having a group like that involved, I think, really validates a lot of the work that we've been previously doing. And if we're able to convert this non-binding agreement into a binding form, it should put us well on the way to achieving some of our goals in terms of timing and getting through probably the trickiest part of what we're doing, which is trying to raise the construction funds to start our operations sometime next year. This one's particularly significant because POSCO is such a large company involved in the anode space, and it's also significant because of the volume.
And they are a lithium battery supplier, is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So POSCO is actually Australia's largest single export customer. So they have, a long tradition of working with Australian companies in the mineral space. And they're primarily a steel producer, one of the largest steel producers in the world. But they also are one of the largest producers of battery materials for the lithium-ion battery sector. So in our case, they're probably the single largest purchaser of the product we want to produce outside of China. And they purchase the kind of graphite we're looking to produce, and then they manufacture lithium-ion battery anodes, which is the negative part of lithium-ion batteries. And then they sell that part as active anode material to battery companies like LG Chem and Samsung.
Apart from finding buyers, what stage is the Sivia mine at now?
Yeah, so we have completed a definitive feasibility study on the mining operation, and our plan is to have a vertically integrated operation that consists of both a mine and then a downstream operation where we take the product we produce at the mine and we upgrade it to get a higher value-added product in purified spherical graphite form. So we're working on getting the downstream part up to the same standard as the mine. We have additional technical work we need to do. We're working on a site selection for that right now. And then we'll have to get the final regulatory approvals for both the mine and for that downstream aspect as well.
That downstream aspect, you said there about value adding, what sort of product would come from that one?
Okay, so what we do in that operation is we take the graphite product we will produce at the mine site and we upgrade it through a two-step process where we spheronize it into very, very small spheres so they can be packed into a lithium-ion battery, and then we purify it to almost 100%. And this very high purity spheronized graphite product is then actually inserted into very small anodes, which go into a larger battery pack.
And that's what POSCO is purchasing?
Exactly. They purchase the purified spherical graphite product, and then they coat it with a proprietary technology, and then they on-sell that to companies like LG Chem and Samsung, who create natural batteries, and then the batteries are then sold to electric vehicle makers like Tesla. Probably the most exciting part about what we're doing is we're hoping to create not just a mining operation, but with this downstream operation, we're doing something that I think is pretty unique for Australian operations, and that's trying to leverage off of something that we have that is very valuable, and that's a resource, and something that we know how to do very well, which is mining, and then try to create a higher value-added product. And what that means for, I think, the people of South Australia is it's an opportunity to be engaged in maybe a further, more technically advanced industry in terms of getting a product to consumers. And what that means is it offers the potential to have not just mining jobs, but the kind of engineering jobs that can build up an industry in one of the fastest growing sectors. And so I think we have a number of, I think, really great mining projects, not just in the state of South Australia, but within Australia generally. And this, I think, is one of the great opportunities to take that to the next step. And what I think really makes it unique is we believe we're going to have a competitive advantage in producing this. And this is really just because of the quality of the resource. And the location in Australia is actually a major advantage for doing this kind of value-added production. And so if we're successful at doing this, we'll be creating not just a series of mining jobs, but also some advanced technology jobs in, again, the renewable energy sector, the lithium-ion battery sector, one of the fastest growing sectors around. And I think it'll have many opportunities for years to come.
Renascor Resources Managing Director David Christensen speaking to Brooke Neindorf about a huge investment on the Eyre Peninsula, and as he outlined there, some big opportunities could flow from this MOU that has been signed between Renascor Resources and POSCO in South Korea. Finally today, though, a bit of a change of tack. I'm wondering, have you ever had to toilet train a toddler? I've heard it's pretty hard yakka. I've never actually had to do it myself. But could you imagine trying to toilet train your livestock? Well, a group of researchers in New Zealand and Germany have done just that. They've toilet trained cows, and it turns out it could be beneficial for your property. Lindsay Matthews is a researcher with the University of Auckland. He spoke more about the research with Amelia Bernasconi, who started by asking the question, we're all wondering, which is why toilet train cattle?
Well, because they, unfortunately, you know, there's a big wee problem. The, you know, they do 2 or 3 litres of urine at a time, and it gushes into a small area in the on the soil, and the plants can't handle it, the soil can't handle it, and that leads to a couple of major issues. One is the excess nitrates run through the soil and into waterways, which is not good for the health of the water or for the people that drink it. And the other is that it gets converted into nitrous oxide, which is a, you know, 300 times more potent a global warming agent than carbon dioxide. So if and cattle all around the world are doing heaps of peas all every day, and so if we can capture some of that and utilize it better, then we can have an impact on, you know, climate change and water quality.
So how did you bribe the cattle to wee in the same spot then?
Well, I wouldn't call it a bribe. It's more of a incentive.
Oh, sorry. I've heard that's how you potty train toddlers with bribes.
Well, so there was really just two simple steps. And we used a procedure that a lot of people use with toddlers, and that is that you associate the place where they need to go. You know, you might have a potty in the bathroom. So here we have a a pen that's clearly identified, nice green pen, green floor and everything. And we rewarded them every time they urinated in there. And then after that, we put them outside the pen and looked to see if they would go into the toilet to urinate. And they did. Sometimes I made a mistake outside, as you do. And so we were giving them a little spray of cold water, a couple of seconds. And it was amazing. You could just see the look of their faces. Oops, I made a mistake. And they, you know, inhibited, and then they trundled down to the toilet, pushed open the door and went in and started again.
Sorry, did you say pushed open a door?
Yeah. So there was a one, you know.
The cattle are backing themselves into that and going for a bit of privacy as well.
Yes. And yep, so it's a one-way door in, so, you know, they went in and then there was another door to come out. But, it was just so that we could be sure that they were, you know, going there to go to the toilet. They wouldn't just wander down there any old time.
I have to ask, how long did it take to train the cows?
Well, that's the really astounding thing. So in that little first phase I've talked about, you know, you put them in the toilet room. That was, most of the animals learned that connection as the right place to go to the loo in 5 or 10 urinations. You know, not days, not months.
Wow.
5 or 10. And then we put them outside, and then we rewarded them for another 10 or 20 urinations, and then they had that as well to go into the toilet to urinate. So around about 20, 25 urinations all up, and, you know, most of the animals were going in there most of the time.
I mean, Lindsay, we are having a bit of a laugh about this, but you touched on the environmental benefits that this research. What sort of benefits could it pose for primary producers if they're getting their cattle to use the potty?
Well, you know, one thing is that, you know, because cattle are vilified a lot for, you know, the methane and the nitrous oxide and the nitrate, so they're vilified. So this has the potential to turn around, you know, how people see the animals, that they can be animal friendly. If we actually ask them to help us, they can help, you know, solve the problem. And but more than that, if you can capture the urine, I mean, it's a, you know, the problem, the reason it's a problem is because it's very nutrient rich and it's just too rich. So there's heaps of nutrients in there that can be utilized and put back in the, you know, onto pastures or whatever in a more dilute sort of controlled way, so it doesn't get this problem of the excess runoff.
It's amazing. University of Auckland researcher Lindsay Matthews speaking there with Amelia Bernasconi about toilet training cattle. And I read that the cows actually learned faster than a toddler as well. It's remarkable. I guess it's more of an issue in Europe where livestock are contained more in barns and things like that. But it sounds like there are also some environmental benefits to it as well. But that is some pretty amazing research there. But cattle are pretty amazing as well. They can learn things quite quickly. I've seen it on my parents' own farm myself. But that's all we have time for in the Country Hour. But Sonia Feldhoff is here. She's toilet trained.
I generally am, but I'm keen to get those trainers over to my stepdaughter's house to train my 2-year-old grandson. They obviously have some pretty good luck on that front.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, just classical sort of behavioural techniques.
Does that mean
amazing.
That cows are cleverer than the average, or they just don't have any fight in them? Like, they don't want to rebel about not doing things they want. I'm not entirely sure.
I think they're beautiful animals, and they want to please you, maybe. Like horses. Horses like to do that,
please
too.
Me by weeing where I tell you to.
Well, they know that you want to do it. I don't know.
Now, it seems that bikes are going missing from backyards. I tell you what, when I had a bike back in the days, well, I've got one now, but, you know, when I was riding my bike, I used to leave it behind. Now it seems thieves are coming to your backyard to take your bikes away. There seems to be an increase in bikes being stolen, and we'll give you a reason why. Maybe, hopefully, also what you can do about it.
My bike lives inside because of that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. It's a bit annoying.
but for we that don't really have reason. Anywhere safe to have it out the back, so it lives inside.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And also on the program today, after 2 o'clock, if you want to get some advice on how to see your vaccination passport, how to perhaps access the business help that's available in the latest COVID surge, Hank Yongan will be joining us and can advise you on how to go about that. So he'll have plenty of questions his way as well. And I know you've been looking at avocados today. On
sure
the Country
have.
Hour.
Love an
avocado. Yeah, and the audit that's going to be done on, because an avocado can be great or it can be terrible, can't it?
It can be.
When they go bad, they're very,
you can't,
very
you can't
bad.
Rescue them at all.
No, really. I've thrown away whole bits of toast because the avocado has ruined the rest of it. And we're going to look at today, you know, people and how they use their avocados, how they test them in the supermarket. Are you a gentle squeezer? Are you just a weigher-upperer? How do you test your avocado in the supermarket?
Well, keep listening to ABC Local Radio. That's it from me. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.